The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
A few of us were sitting together this afternoon, and the discussion reminded me of a story that I told them, so they'll bear with me for a minute. But it really is a great way of sort of presenting this challenge. I have a very close friend who met his wife when she was 16 years old and he was 21. This does not an easy dating process make. He was an advisor in a youth group, whatever, NCSY, and she was a camper. You can't really date your campers because, you know, if you want to get a wife, instead you get 20, right? So, you know what I mean? Inside. So he had to wait. He waited until she was 18. The day she turned 18, he announced his intentions to her rather boldly. He'd been in love with her for 2 years, you know, wants to date her, etc. And she very cleverly ignored him. And he pursued her for 9 years. Okay? This is the when is it time to get a life question. Okay? In fact, this girl turned out to be my wife's roommate in college. And she would describe sort of how he would call from Israel. And she would be on this long distance call from Israel. And then she would say, oh, just a minute, and have a conversation with a friend and say, yeah. And then she would hold the phone. She really wasn't into it, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. Anyway, eventually, in fact, they came to the conclusion years later that had she said yes before he went to Israel, the amount of money that he spent on the phone bill that year could have bought them their house, right?
Yeah.
Okay, live and learn. Eventually, she finally wised up and decided that somebody who was that crazy about her and was willing to give up so much for her, maybe she should really explore whether he was the right guy. And eventually, they got married. And they live on our block. We're very close to them. They have 7 kids. Seems to me it's working out well. Worth his weight. And, you know, we joke about it all the time. At their wedding, under the chuppah, her father quoted the Talmud. Talmud says, you know, God used to be so busy. He was doing all these miracles. Has to split the sea, 10 plagues. What does God do now? There are no more miracles. So he says, ever since the sea was split, God sits in heaven arranging matches. Zivugin. And kasha zivugin kekriyat yamsuf. And believe me, making matches in this world for marriage is as difficult as splitting the sea. And this girl's father looked at my friend Baruch under the chuppah and said, and by you, Baruch, it was bucket by bucket. And that seems to be part of the question. You know, I didn't really choose these the topics. Stacy and whoever else came up with them, they just figured like they couldn't wait for me anymore to figure exactly what I was going to talk about. So they picked an album, you know, they just said, okay, Beatles, right? And I looked and I saw what the titles were. But the truth is, it's a very good question. Because that's what really people think. All you need is love, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. All you need, am I mentioning 2 songs? All you need is love! You know, actually, when you're in trouble, if later you give this class to a group and they say, who are the Beatles? Then you know you're old. Baruch Hashem here. All you need is love. And on the one hand, it's really true. You know, perhaps the most important thing in this world is love. I recently had the privilege, we have a student in New York, he's not here, and his grandmother is down in Florida. It's a challenging story. His grandparents had a business, the business was going very well, they were very well to do, in fact maybe even wealthy, and they eventually moved down to Florida, and they lived in Florida for whatever, 10, 15, 20 years, and they had given over the business to whoever they gave it over to, thinking they could live forever off of the profit from the business. Apparently the people they gave it over to ran the business into the ground. And all of a sudden they found themselves without any income. Her husband passed away. She's down in Florida. She was in her 80s. No money. Then they discovered that for her to come back up to New York, where most of the relatives lived, wasn't going to work because by virtue of the fact that she was now in the state of Florida, she couldn't get insurance coverage at this age up in New York. So she has to stay in Florida. So she's living in a home in Florida. She's over 95. She has her faculties. She's a put-together woman. She has amazing stories to tell. And she's all alone. And this devoted grandson, whenever he can, he comes down to Florida. And he finally wrote me this really long letter. And he said that his grandmother there, turns out that his grandmother's like literally a 10-minute drive from where I am in Florida. So every Friday afternoon, I take my daughter. I was looking for a chesed project, for a project of kindness. You know, there are three foundations, three pillars on which the world stands. That's what it says in the Mishnah, in Ethics of the Fathers. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chesedim. Torah, everybody talks about. How do you study Torah? When do you study Torah? Where do you study Torah? Everybody's talking about how to develop your acumen in Torah, how to make sure you're learning Torah. Avodah, the synagogue connection. People talk about the fact that we have to develop a relationship with God, get more involved in our community, in the synagogue. People go to pray. Where did you go to services? But chesed? How many people have a chesed project? How many people weekly make it their business to visit a hospital, to visit sick people, to do the kind of acts of loving kindness that nobody does? Very challenging. So as a parent, you know, you look for these opportunities with your children. So I started taking my aunt. It's been an amazing experience to watch her connect with this woman, to watch her relate to other people there. And like, I'm just at the beginning, you bring your guitar. It's actually the most incredible audience, because when I finished sitting with this woman, so it's Friday afternoon, they do a Kabbalah Shabbat. You think Israelite has a weird clock? They do Kabbalah Shabbat there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But that's when whoever the rabbi in the neighborhood is can come. So he comes and they all sit there. I want you to know, you never had such an attentive audience in your life. The first time I was there, I realized they were all sitting there in this dining room, you know, 80 people, and they're waiting, and I don't know what they're waiting for, right? And, you know, they said that the Kabbalah Shabbat service is going to start in like 20 minutes. Well, they don't have anywhere else to go, right? They don't have anywhere else to go, so they're just waiting for the service. Did you ever see such a thing? To go to synagogue, the whole community is waiting there 20 minutes for the rabbi? Never saw such a thing. So I'm there, I'm with my guitar, my aunt is there, so I started playing them some Nigunim. You know, and at first it was very challenging because, you know, it is really like, you know, you play Nigun and people start to, you know, get into it. But here's people and they're sitting like, you know, and then I got really excited because somebody on the table was going like this. And, wow, she's really into it. We're rocking here, you know. And this woman who has such a story and so much to share is all alone. So on the one hand, it's true. All you need is love. If you can find people to be with you, and yet, it's not so true. Because love isn't always enough. Or maybe we have to define what love is. You know, Rabbi Aaron pointed this out this morning, but maybe just to define it a little more. Love is all about giving. And we've spoken about this, some of us, before, but just so we all share the same parameters and definitions, the Hebrew word for love is ava. In the Aramaic, hav means to give. Love is all about giving. In fact, the fundamental difference between love and lust is that love is all about giving and lust is all about taking. Love is where I see the other person and lust is where I see myself. And that's why love grows and lust wanes. So I once met a fellow, fascinating. And this guy, he came to me, he was in such a struggle because he felt like he had done everything for his wife. He was always there for her. He was always picking things up and putting things away and doing things in the house and leaving her notes. Of course, you know, he didn't know Rabbi Aaron yet, so he didn't understand that that was a problem. And, you know, they had kids and everything. And just everything. And his wife, he said, my wife, she never had to ask for anything. I gave her everything. And I would do everything. And he said, you know, I wasn't one of these husbands who was away all the time and just leaving my credit card. I would come home and I would do things for her, whatever. Until one day, I didn't even see it coming. I came home to a note. And the note said, I can't take it anymore. And she just left. And she met somebody else, and she's with somebody else. So if love is all about giving, and you're doing all of this giving, then how can it be that sometimes that's not enough? What really is love is about? What does it mean that we need love? How can it be that sometimes in a relationship you give so much? And I want you to understand, this is a very challenging question. Because it's true that sometimes people think that love is something you find, and that's clearly not the case. But then people get to a different level and they recognize that love is about giving. And so they start to assume that if I'm giving, I've got it all. But that's not true either. In fact, if you're in a relationship where you're doing all the giving, that's almost a guarantee for disaster. So how do I do that? How do I know what love is? How do I know when to give? How do I know when not to give? How do I find the balance? What is the balance? What is love if love is not giving? And what does it mean that love is all you need? What is needing? So I want to share with you a couple of ideas. And given that it's Friday afternoon, and I think it's very important to have a chance to get ready for Shabbat and get some air, so I'll try not to be too long, and then I'll open the floor to questions and see what's on your mind. And there are really two basic ideas that I think are crucial. You know, people think, and this is true with every relationship, but as an example in marriage, people spend so much time looking for the right person. And by the way, when you really stop to think about it, that's not the challenge. The challenge really is not to look for the right person. Because at the end of the day, how do you find the right person? There's no recipe for finding the right person. You can go to all the retreats in the world and never meet someone. And you can sit at home and come outside to get the mail, and that someone can be coming out of the elevator. So it's really not about looking for the right person. It's at least first about becoming the right person, so that the person who's looking for you will find you. But people spend a tremendous amount of time investing in this process, eventually find the right person, and maybe they're right, and then they get married. And they think, now I'm there. And that's clearly not true. In fact, it's fascinating. The statistics on divorce in the Western world, and I only know them for America, are frightening. In the last 10 years alone, the statistic for late divorce, which means people who get divorced after 25 years of marriage or more, is up by over 60%. You are twice as likely in American society today, God forbid, to get divorced after your 25th anniversary as you were 11 years ago. And I've met a number of people who are challenged with this issue. In fact, I've met people who are still married, and one partner will confide in me that they should have divorced the other partner long ago, but they couldn't do it to the children. So they're staying together for the children. As soon as they feel the children are free, then they're ready to free themselves and move on. And if you're married and you're staying together for the children, that's not marriage. That's babysitting. That's not what it's meant to be. So how do you make it? But it's sad, right? How do you make it what it's meant to be? What is this process of marriage? So I want to share with you two ideas. One is how a relationship is meant to work. And I think that if we would try to cover this entire topic and the little bit of knowledge that I have to share and a little bit of knowledge, you know, that's out there with everybody else of Israelite to share, I think personally it would be too much. It would be overload. You know, that's something we need to do seminar by seminar, book by book, and I urge you to read Rabbi Aaron's books because there's a lot of wisdom there. And by the way, there's a great, I'm not a hawker of tapes, but it happens to be that whenever a couple gets married and they haven't heard this, I give them this tape as a present. There's a tape that Rabbi Aaron has on love and relationships, for secrets to love and relationships, which is a beautiful idea that you can explore on your own. So I want to share with you one idea about being in relationships, and one idea about finding relationships. About whether or not there really are soulmates out there, am I waiting for my soulmate, how do I know if I found my soulmate, etc. So first of all, I want you to understand that there is a concept called Izun HaNishama. Izun means balance. Balance is the root, the basis of everything. If I don't find balance, in fact, Maimonides, the Rambam, in his Laws of Character Traits, suggests that the root of being a mensch, the root of being an ethical person, the root of human behavior, the root of success of all relationships, my ability to have a healthy relationship, first of all, of course, with myself, with my fellow human beings, with the people that I love, and of course with Hashem, it's all based on balance. And when my life is unbalanced, my relationships will be unbalanced. And by the way, when my relationships are imbalanced, then my life will be imbalanced. And the imbalance that I have in my life will affect all of the lives around me, and on a certain level will imbalance their lives as well. Now what does this mean? I'll give you just one example. Because part of the aspect of Izun HaNishama, of balance, literally balance of the soul, is that it's not healthy for a person to do too much giving. I want you to know, the first time I came across this idea, that's a very challenging idea. Because I always thought, you know, there should be no end to giving. And there are two aspects to who we are. There is the physical side to ourselves, and there is the spiritual side to ourselves. And the physical side to who we are, of course, is limited. That's the definition of what is physical. Everything that's physical is limited. In fact, Maimonides goes so far as to say that God cannot be physical, which is a challenging idea, because if God was physical, then God would be here and not there. And Hashem is everywhere. And this was Maimonides' response to Christian theology on certain levels. So anything that is physical is limited. It's here now and it's gone tomorrow. And by definition, anything which is unlimited is spiritual. And anything which is spiritual is unlimited. So all those aspects of ourselves that are unlimited are really spiritual. The ability to love, the ability to give, the ability to care. All of these are unlimited. There is no limit to how much you can love. In fact, I remember when Yonatan was due to be born, our second child, we had this conversation, my wife and I. I remember late at night, we're lining up and we're talking. And I look back at it now, it's one of the most ridiculous conversations I ever remember having. And I have since met countless couples who all admit to having the same conversation. Okay? We had a child already, thank God, a healthy child, Mayan. And we were so in love with our daughter. And I couldn't imagine that you could ever love someone so much as to love a child. I never understood that. And now we're going to have another child. And my wife says to me, what are we going to do? Now, when your wife says to you, what are we going to do? You immediately know that you're on dangerous ground. You have to be very careful to listen well and to answer correctly. Okay, what are we going to do? So I'm thinking for a second. I say, I don't know. That's a safe answer, right? She says, no, I mean, like, we're going to have this baby. And we love Mayan so much. How are we going to make room to love Yonatan as well? And my mind is thinking, because this is the difference between men and women, okay, I'm not understanding this problem, but I have to be very careful here. So I say the most important word that you can ever learn in any relationship, be it parents and children, be it husband and wife, anything, teacher and student. Do you know what the single most important word in healthy relationships? If you walk away from this retreat with nothing else but this word, yours will be the earth. Do you know what that word is? That's a very powerful word. I want you to know, it took me a long time to learn this word. This is a good word to learn. I've had the best conversations with my wife because I learned the power of Right? And your wife will tell you afterwards, that was such a great conversation. All you said was Right? And if you listen to every Aaron's class, you understand why that's so important. Okay. So I said, And we got into this deep conversation because, of course, how could you add love? I mean, I love Mayan so much. Where is there going to be room to love Yonatan? And then, of course, Yonatan is born. And you realize there's no limit to how much love you can have. You can love as many children as you can have. You can love as many people as you can meet. You can love as many people as you can think of. In fact, some people develop their souls so that their souls are so large that they can love a whole world. That's the definition in Judaism of a tzaddik. Anybody here ever had the privilege of meeting Sarah Shlomo Kalbach? There was a person, I mean, no person in this world is perfect, but if you could ever say of a person, maybe this person succeeded in loving everybody, maybe it was him. Amazing. So I always thought, love everybody. Love endlessly. Love with unlimited capacity. And give. Somebody comes to you and needs something, give. How could you ever say no? Why would you ever say no? Why would you ever want to stop giving? So I want you to know it's not so simple. Because if you're doing all the giving, the soul needs to be in balance. When I give to someone, it's not healthy for their soul if they don't find a way to give back. I'll give you an example. If a fellow beggar comes to the door and he wants some tzedakah, and you're feeling in a good mood, so you give him, I don't know, $100 bill. Psh, you're in a good mood. So he feels great. But you've actually, on a certain level, done him a disservice. If you would come to the door and you would say, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Listen, I need to move this whole bookcase over to that side of the room and I have no help. Could you help me? And the guy comes in for 20 minutes and sweats with you and moves the bookcase to the other side of the room. And then you give him the $100 bill? His soul is much more balanced because he's given for what he's received, and that's healthy. And that's the nature of relationships. Hashem created us. You know, why was the world created? The world was created, I mean, we can never really understand why the world was created. Kabbalah teaches, Hasidut is full of this, that essentially the act of the creation of the world was an act of kindness that's so huge, it's so beyond our comprehension as to be incomprehensible. It was an act of kindness that was so great. Hashem did something for us, even though there was no us yet. Hashem did something for us just because Hashem loves us. Most people have tremendous difficulty with that. Why would anybody want to do unlimited kindness for me? But in the process of the creation of the world, in the process of our growth as human beings, Hashem actually wants something back. Hashem wants us to participate as partners in the creation of the world. In fact, in the beginning of creation, Hashem says, with regards to all of the created items, you know, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, God says, let there be light. Vayomer Elokim Yekavu Amayim, God says, let the waters come together. Let there be grass and trees until God comes to creating us. And then God says, Na'ase Adam, let us make man. And all the rabbis say, well, who is God talking to? when God says, let us make man. And Rav Soloveitchik has a magnificent perception. He says, God is talking to us. Hashem is saying to us, I want you to be partners with me in the creation of you every single day. We become partners in the creation of the world all over again every morning. That's, by the way, why the blessings in the morning service, Yotzer, all about creation, I have an opportunity to recreate the world all over again every morning. We're partners in creation. And the reason that we're partners in creation, you should know that there's a switchboard somewhere, and they know when Benny Friedman's giving a class, and they do this regularly. They send planes and trucks. Just wait a moment. It's a plan. I have this in Israel when I'm in the old city. They find the garbage trucks and send them one at a time throughout the doors. We'll see. The reason that we need to be partners in creation is not because God needs our help. That's ridiculous. It's because we need to be partners in giving. It's not healthy to be receiving. Now understand that there is a basis for this, which will bring us back to our question. When the world is created, it says, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. The name of God that is used to refer to the beginning of the process of the creation of the world is Elohim. Elohim. And Elohim traditionally is the name referring to justice, din. Okay? And the reason that that's the name that refers to justice is because the way that justice works is that I give you because you deserve it. Because you've given me. Right? If you fix my car on Wednesday, then I have a chance to fix your lawnmower on Tuesday. So that's great. So I did for you, you did for me, and that's din. And therefore, really, the way the world should be is that Hashem only gives us what we've earned. And as a matter of fact, there's a Kabbalistic concept called lachma de kisufa, which literally means bread of shame. Bread represents all that we're given in this world. There are different types of bread. There's lechem min hashamayim, bread from heaven, where it's very clear to us that God just gives this to us as a gift, like manna in the desert, or a lottery ticket that you just win. You didn't do anything to earn that. Hashem just gave it to you. And then there's lechem min haaretz, bread that you earn. I want you to know that if you could earn $100,000 next week, you would have a much healthier relationship with yourself if you found a way to earn it than if you won it on a lottery ticket, even if it's the same amount of money. So when we get upstairs, supposedly, whatever that means, we're going to have an intense experience. And that intense experience is not like, you know, sort of some religions and theologies have this perception of damnation and purgatory. The experience somehow, and I can't tell you I understand this, when I get there I'll send back a telegram, but till then I'm just talking in theory. But when we get there, we will experience that for all those things that we were given in this world, that we really didn't earn, we will feel an intense shame, a kisufa. And we don't want to experience that. It's kind of like, imagine that you get home next week, and somebody picks you up in a limo, and you don't know why they're picking you up in a limo, and they take you to the big synagogue, and you're all excited, and you don't know what's going on, very confusing, and you walk in and there's a big dinner, and you're the guest of honor. And they're honoring you because they're supporting an orphanage, and you're the guest of honor. You don't know from the orphanage, you don't know from the synagogue, you don't know what's going on. You don't feel great that you're being honored. You feel silly. You feel embarrassed because you haven't earned it. You don't want to be honored for things that you haven't earned. In fact, you're not even sure you want to be honored for things you have earned. So that's lachma de kisufa, that's a sense of shame. So if I can earn the things that I'm given, then I reduce that. But you see, Hashem realized that the world couldn't work that way. We're not capable of earning everything Hashem has to give us. That's how great Hashem is. So Hashem continued the process with a different name, the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, and the Hey, which is generally associated with the God of mercy, of compassion. And in compassion, Hashem gives us that which we really don't earn and we don't deserve. And our challenge is to attempt to find that balance. Now this is a practical issue in all relationships. Because sometimes we just want to give, and sometimes we just want to take. You know, I was just talking to somebody today, and it's very interesting. A lot of people here, I imagine, are looking for the right person. And I want you to know this is true not only in relationships of love, romantic love, and it's not only true in relationships of people who are looking for romantic love, it's true for relationships where people think they've found or have found romantic love and are attempting to hang on to them or to build them. It's true for parenting. It's true for every type of relationship you can imagine. But we'll use this as an example. So you ask the average person, what are you looking for in a person? I always find it funny, you know, you read these ads, these singles ads, you know? Looking for, right? Now, picture what you put after looking for, okay? Because you've got to be different, right? So you're looking for someone who's nice. There's a surprise, right? You're looking for someone who's funny. In other words, I've decided that this week I don't want to find the miserable wretch that I used to be looking for, right? Okay. And it's interesting what people are looking for. And so sometimes people will say, I just want somebody who's really going to be there for me. And that's very interesting. You see? The plane's gone. Now they found something else. I'm telling you. They send them out. It's like a system, right? In fact, they even have it down to when I get to certain points. But okay. It's interesting that the average person will say, I want someone who's really going to be there for me. Think about what that means. That means that the focus of my relationship is about me. What about I'm looking for someone for whom I can really be there? I want to find someone, not what does he or she give to me, what do I have to give to them? I want to find someone I feel I can really be there for. But I want you to know, that's also off balance. Because really what I'm looking for is someone who can be there for me and someone for whom I can be there. That's balance. It's true, by the way, in terms of parenting as well. You see, part of the challenge of parenting is that when you have children at the beginning, why do you love your children so much? Because if love is all about giving, so you're doing all the loving. I mean, what is a 3-month-old baby doing for you? It's just being there. Nothing. In fact, there's a story that's told, and you can't misunderstand the story, but Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the son of the Rav Soloveitchik, so one of my Rebbe, also the Rebbe of my Rebbe's, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, is the son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik. And his wife was Rav Soloveitchik's daughter. So when they had one of their children, Reb Chaim, who was a big Torah scholar in Yeshiva University, so he came to visit them, just, you know, perchance. And the baby was 2 months old. And they brought out the 2-month-old baby for the uncle to see. You know? Look, this is your nephew, whatever. Say, hey, looks the baby. And, you know, Reb Chaim is not known as a particularly effusive, warm, emotional, mushy-gushy fellow. He's a rational, logical, he's a tremendous Torah scholar, but you know, everybody has their path. So he looks at the baby, he's holding the baby, says, you know what, bring him back to me when he's a human. What did he mean? What he meant was, I can't yet have a relationship with this child. And I want you to know this is very true. I remember when Mayan was born, I was going to be super dad. I was determined to be super dad. In fact, while Dorit was pregnant, I read through like 4 different books on pregnancy. The entire Columbia University book on pregnancy. In fact, I got so good at all this material that some of Dorit's friends who were pregnant, they would ask her to ask me about symptoms they were experiencing. I was like, oh yeah, that's Braxton Hicks, don't worry about it. You know, I got to know this stuff. And I was fascinated by the process that the embryo was going through. In fact, I finally realized when Dorit was pregnant about 6 and a half months, that was the point at which the ear canal develops and a baby can hear. Inside the womb. So I decided to test this. And one night, I put on like Mick Jagger music. And sure enough, after a while, the baby started kicking. And then I put on Vivaldi. And after a while, the baby calmed down. And this freaked me out. And all of a sudden, I started to realize that this baby could hear what I was saying. So I decided to have a relationship with this child before it was born. And I'm convinced I'm very close with each of my children, especially my aunt, because I had the time to do this. Now, you know, if anybody would have, you know, walked over and I would have been talking to my wife's stomach, said, okay, a little shy of a clock there. But, you know, and you realize that you're a parent long before the baby's born. But you're not really a parent because you're doing all the giving. You have no relationship with this child. You're loving this child because of what you give to the child. And eventually the child wants to give back. And the child wants to give back because where is the child? Is if I'm doing all the giving, then I'm really there. But the child isn't. And the challenge for a parent is to know when to step out of the way to make room for the child to give back. So I have to find this balance. And I want someone for whom I can be there, and I want someone who can really be there for me. And that leads us to the second question. And this is really challenging. How on earth are you ever supposed to find this? How can you find this? We have a couple who's sitting here, you're married. How long are you married?
7 months.
7 months. So I'll be honest with you. You know, you guys are terrific. You can't possibly know this yet. I hope, Bezrat Hashem. You can't know, even when you're married already, whether you're really going to be there for each other through thick and thin, because Bezrat Hashem, God willing, you haven't had that much thin yet. And that's very challenging. So if you can't even know that after you're married, necessarily right away. How could you know that before you're married? How could you ever date a person and know whether they're really going to be there for you? That's so challenging. In fact, on a certain level, until you're really committed to each other, how can you even be there to begin with? Because a part of you isn't there yet, so how can you know whether you're going to be there? So I want to share with you a second idea. And this is very much a personal opinion. And there's no right or wrong in this. It's just really valuable to be aware of different paths and different journeys. Because I think, you know, what Rabbi Aaron was saying earlier is true. There's a crisis almost in the Jewish community. And there's so many people who are such fine, incredible people. Some of them sitting here. Who are looking for the right person. And who so deserve to find the right person. And yet, we seem to be a little bit stuck as a community. And by the way, just to be clear, you know, people have this issue. You know, that if somebody's 30 or 40 or 50 and not married, they must be doing something wrong. I want you to know it's not true. I honestly don't believe, I've met too many people, I don't believe that if a person is 40 years old, 50 years old, and has not yet found the right person, that they've done necessarily anything wrong. Putting aside the mystical perception that if this is your path and if this is what you're meant to experience till now, etc. I don't believe this is the responsibility of any one individual. This is the responsibility which falls on the entire Jewish community. We as a community have gone off. We've failed to a certain degree to find the process, and I want to understand that. So I want to share with you an idea. What you do with this idea is very challenging, but at least there's food for thought. You see, the Torah paints two paradigms for how a relationship develops. And I want you to know that I'm still processing this, years later. Because on a certain level, you might think that there is the one or the other, and the one is right and the other is wrong, but that can't be, because the Torah gives you both of them. And you might suggest that these paradigms are called Yaakov and Yitzchak. When Yaakov finds his love, what happens? He's leaving home. He comes down to the house of Lavan, who will become his father-in-law. And he arrives at a well. And he sees that there are a bunch of shepherds sitting around the well. And there's a huge boulder across the entrance of the well. And they're just sitting around. So he starts asking them, why are you all sitting around? He said, well, we're waiting for enough guys to come to roll the stone off the well. There's a big discussion as to why they're all waiting for the stone to roll off the well. But one possibility is very simple. It's just a huge, heavy boulder. So then, of course, you say, well, if they actually succeed in getting the boulder off the well, why would they ever put it back on? Once they got it off, keep it off. And then whenever you want, anybody can take water. So apparently this is some sort of an economic thing, that they should all be together when they take the stone off the well. It's always about money. So there, you know, nobody takes more than the next. Let's assume that's so. Yaakov is watching this. They don't know who he is. And all of a sudden, Vayhi it was, right? He sees Rachel. Vehine Rachel ba'i matzon. And behold, Rachel is coming with the flocks. Vayar, and Yaakov sees Rachel from a distance. Vayagel et ha'even, and he rolls, all of a sudden jumps down, Superman, Popeye, rolls the boulder off the well, sees Rachel, it's incredible. And then the Torah says, Vayishakla, and he kisses her. This is the line that they skip when you're in yeshiva, you know, they move on. And of course, that's a very deep idea, we won't go there right now. We come to Israel, we can have a whole discussion. Vayisad kolovayef. And he lifts up his voice and he cries. Now he lifts up his voice and he cries because he sees somewhere in the future that his time with Rachel will be limited. Which means there will be only so much that he can give to her. And that causes him pain. That's one way of understanding it. But Yaakov has this intense experience with Rachel. And then they go back to Rachel's home and he meets Rachel's father and he's willing to put up with her father, who is not a simple fellow. Rather unsavory character, for 7 years to marry Rachel. And then some of you know the story, Lavan switches the daughters, he ends up being fooled, marrying Leah, and he ends up having to work another 7 years. And they are in his eyes as just days. In his love for her. His love for her, his perception of what he has to give to her, his perception of what she will be able to give to him. The intenseness of that experience is so powerful from the moment he sees her that he is willing to develop and to wait and to work until she's his. And he's hers. Yitzchak is exactly the opposite. Almost exactly. In fact, Yitzchak never even meets his beloved. Someone else goes to find her. Avram sends Eliezer, the servant, to go and find the bride for Yitzchak. He finds Rivka. It's a long story how he finds her. He decides she's the right girl for him. He brings her back. They so are out of the potential yet of a relationship that when Rivka sees Yitzchak standing out in the field, communing with God, she asks Eliezer, who is this? And he tells her, oh, that's Yitzchak. In other words, oh, that's your husband. You know what she does? She falls off her camel. You can imagine on Purim afternoons the Hasidim have a field day with this verse. And then it says, Vayikach Yitzchak et Rivka, and Yitzchak takes Rivka, Vayiviyah ol Asarah, and he brings her home to the tent that was his mother's. That's a whole other discussion. Vayehaver, and he loves her. So, Vayikach, Kicha in the Torah is a language of betrothal of marriage. It does not say that Yitzchak loves Rivka until after they're married. How could that be? The love that Yitzchak develops comes after marriage. And I'll tell you something interesting. If you really stop to think about what love is, how could you ever really find love, develop love, discover love, before marriage? And there are two points to consider with regards to this equation. The first is what love is really about. If love is really about giving, you know, somebody I'm close with once had an experience. What do you do if you wake up one day and you discover that someone you thought you loved, you really don't? You ever have this experience, you're dating someone and you love them and you think they could be the right person, but you're afraid? In fact, people who are married tell me this. My brother confided in me that he had this deep experience. He went out with his now wife for many years, for 2 years before they got married, and the thing that freaked him out the most was, what if one day, 2 years from now, I'm married and I wake up and I realize I don't love her? What would you do? And I'll tell you something. There is no guarantee that you won't wake up one morning and you won't love her. But there is a very simple solution. There's actually a recipe for deciding that you want to love someone and to be in love with someone. It's very simple. In order to love someone, if you've ever dated someone and you say, wow, this is a perfect recipe, I wish I could love this person. So within certain parameters, the Talmud, for example, says you're not allowed to marry somebody without seeing them because you might find them abhorrent to you. Which means that you can't marry somebody you find abhorrent, which means that there's a range. Because everybody is beautiful in somebody's eyes. So somebody has to be within a certain range. But there is a recipe, assuming that someone is within that range, for deciding that you wish to love someone and for loving them. And the recipe for loving someone is loving them. Why? Because love is not a noun. Love is a verb. If love is all about giving and commitment and sacrifice, if it's all about what you put into a relationship, so if you think about it, until you're committed to that relationship, how can you ever really put in everything you're meant to put in? And imagine, by the way, that you're married. And you think, after 10 years, what if I was meant to marry somebody else? And this brings me to the third and the last point. And I want you to know, there's no truth in this topic. There's merely food for thought. There are many different ways of looking at this, and I'm going to share one with you. I'm not convinced it's the only way, but I think it's very healthy to be aware that this way exists. Now, do you ever wonder about this question, Bashert? Is there such a thing as a soulmate? I've never met anybody who didn't wonder about this at some point. You know? In fact, when I got married, I was convinced that I had found the right person. I never really had any doubts before I got married. You know? And to be honest, I've never really had serious doubts since I got married. In fact, I remember the exact moment, and anybody who's ever met me heard this at some point, because it still boggles my mind that I was silly enough to believe this at the time. But I can tell you the exact moment that I realized and knew that my wife was the right person for me. I met my wife on a Thursday afternoon, and we had a very intense relationship, you know. We were talking to each other all the time, couldn't get off the phone, etc. And I went out to the place where she was working for the summer, on the kibbutz, and, you know, I sat up with her, and we're sitting and talking. It's a Tuesday night, it's like 4 days later, and she looks at me, and she says, I want you to know that I know that we're going to get married. It's true. She says, I know we're going to get married. And then she looks at me and says, and I know that you know we're going to get married. She says, when you know that you know, let me know. And the reason I knew she was right was because I didn't run away. Now, when you look back at it, I mean, I'm married only 15 years. And to imagine that I could know that this person was right for me is ridiculous. So part of it is I was young, I was 25, so I was too young to be wise enough to realize that I couldn't know. I was dumb enough to think that I did know. So I got married. By the time I realized I didn't know, it didn't matter because I was already married. And since love is all about getting to know each other, so I was already married, I might as well put the work in. But what if I knew that before I got married? What if I knew that I couldn't know until I got married? What if I just decided that this is a person with whom I should take that risk? So the real question is not whether you know this is the right person. The real question is, could you know this is the right person? Now the Rambam says a fascinating thing in the Guide to the Perplexed. On this topic, and I'm going to translate it. This isn't quite the way he says it, but it's a valuable piece of information. Imagine for the moment that there is a perfect 10. And I do believe this is true by the law of statistics, if nothing else, but on a mystical level. Let's say there's a perfect 10. Let's say there's another person in this world who is so perfect for you, who is so right, who loves everything you love, who is prepared to do everything you're prepared to do, who is so in sync with who you are, that if you marry them, perfection. So maybe somebody merits to meet such a person. By the way, I'm not sure that's a merit or a curse, because there's a value to working in a relationship, but okay. Now let's say you didn't meet a 10. Let's say you met a 9. She's an amazing person. She loves everything you love, but never, she likes the Yankees, you like the Mets. What are you going to do? That's very serious. But okay. Right? See, I have somebody who understands. So, okay. So, if you're willing to put a little work into such a relationship, you can turn that relationship into a 10. What if you meet an 8? If you meet an 8, you have work to do. Maybe there's some things you share and some things you have different interests in. So, if you're willing to put the work in, and she's willing to put the work in, and it's a lot of work to make a marriage work, then you can turn that 8 into a 10. Now what if you meet a 2? 2 is a lot of work. If you meet a 2, wait, for sure you'll find a 3. So don't marry a 2. And you know how you'll know you found a 2? Because if you found a 2, the probability, although some people are on a level where they can turn a 2 into a 10, but most people can't. That's why there's a mitzvah in the Torah to get a divorce. Sometimes you meet a 2, Nebuch, and you're in 2 land, and you can't get out of 2 land. And 2 land is turning into 1 land, only not the type of one we want. So there's a mitzvah to get a divorce, and that doesn't mean, by the way, that you married the wrong person. That means that that person came into your life to teach you something so that you'll be ready to go find your 10. So here's my question to you. I don't know what the number is. If you marry a 7, work at it. If you meet a 7, work enough to make a marriage. If you meet a 3, don't. I don't know. If I meet a 7, and I'm willing to work, and she's willing to work, we could turn it into a 10. If I meet a 9, and we're willing to work, we could turn it into a 10. So why do I need to know whether she's a 7 or a 9? I don't. All I need to know is that she wants to put in the work, and that I want to put in the work. And that's the challenge. And that's, I think, what Yitzchak understands. Eliezer, the servant, was looking for someone who was willing to put in the work. But you can't know what the result of that work will be because you're not yet in the work. It's like finding a business partner on a certain level. You want to find someone you can trust. You want to find someone you can work with. But you can't know it's going to work. How can you know it's going to work? What you can get a sense of is that this person really wants to make it work. And if you can find someone who really wants to make it work, that's worth an effort. Because how often do you meet people like that? And there's so many people in this world who meet people, 7s, 8s, 9s, if you want to make it statistical. People that are so wonderful. People who are willing to put in the work. And that's the challenge. Am I willing to take that leap? Some people, they find a Yaakov. Some people, they find a Yitzchak. I'm not so sure it's so simple to define the difference. I think that every relationship that starts as a Yaakov ends up as a Yitzchak, because you have to put in the work after marriage. And every relationship that begins as a Yitzchak, they'll look back and they realize they had a Yaakov because they met. So what's the difference? So that's a little bit of food for thought. On the process of sharing and growing and giving and loving and meeting and needing and finding and working and most of all, of creating. And I want you to know, I bless every person in this room, Bezrat Hashem, that if you found a person and you're with a person, that Hashem should give you the strength to put in all the work because it's so worthwhile. And if you haven't yet found the person, that you should be willing to put in the work to find the person. And that Hashem should bless you to meet Rabbi Aaron. I want you to know, everybody here, because he's too nice, he's shy, you know, whatever. Is he here? He's still here, right? I want you to know, he loves this. He won't tell you this, but he loves this. You should, and I'm going to get in trouble with this, you should get in his face. Go over to him if you meet somebody, if you want to meet somebody, and then you have to nudge him. And if nothing else comes out of this retreat, but that some people find the right people, life is great. And by the way, we have a standing rule at Israelite. which is that if your wedding in any way, shape, or form comes out of Israelite, you have to serve chocolate mousse at the wedding. That's the deal. So we're clear. Okay.
Parma?
It doesn't have to be Parma. Up to you. Okay? Anyway, that's a little food for thought on the topic of love and relationships. You can, by the way, translate this entire discussion into every single aspect of your life. Your relationship with God, your relationship with yourself, your relationship with your fellow human being. This is the secret of Shabbat. And if anybody's curious about this, we can talk about this more. If anybody has any questions, Shabbat Shalom.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.